to live righteously.
Hey, it's me, Richie T, and it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode number 132, where in the second and third block, we talk all about excommunication. Certainly a hot topic this week because of the whole letters to John DeLynn and to Kate Kelly talking about their disciplinary council, where they could potentially be excommunicated. We get into that here in this episode, but we talk about kind of a history of excommunication. So make sure you stick around for the second and third blocks. Just a couple emails I want to share before we get started. This one from Crystal. She says, Cultural Hall, love the show. Working on being a lifer, meaning she'll listen to every episode of the Cultural Hall, but not there yet. So just a convert. She says, I had an idea. As I'm listening to your musical guests, I think it would be awesome if you could have all the songs that were recorded here on a part. That way we can just hear the songs without listening to the whole episode or scrolling and trying to find them. What do you think? Crystal, I think that that's a great idea. If you will do me a favor, and as you reach lifer status, if you'll let me know in which episodes there are music and at what time marks there are in each of those, I will cut those out and put them together as various artists and have it available for you at the website. There, I just gave you a calling, Crystal. Take that. Next, here we go. The Cultural Hall show crew says, I'm a recent convert to the show, and so far it's really fun. I have a suggestion for the fast offerings portion of the Articles of News. Articles of News comes out every Sunday, or every Monday, I should say, except for when I'm on vacation, then it comes out later that week. But the fast offerings section is where we go through articles of news quickly. Anyway, so now back to the email. Currently, says Catherine, I don't understand the difference between the fast offerings and the regular articles of news because they don't seem to be offered fast. She says, I can't tell that they are any faster than the regular articles, so here are a couple of suggestions. Number one, she says, limit the story to the headlines or 140 characters. For the full story, people can go to your website. I like that. Or two, similar to the, quote, lightning round on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, turn the headlines into a quiz, but still only share the headlines. Let people find the full story on the website. I like that, too. Alternately, if you keep the current format of reading the entire story that accompanies the fast offering, just change the name to Generous Fast Offerings. And then she puts in parentheses, please don't actually do that. Thanks for the show. Keep it up, Catherine. All right. Well, we'll talk about it. We'll get it in on the panel and see what people think about that. You can also weigh in if you hear that and go, no, Catherine, you're wrong. Or you're missing it, or whatever. You can give us your feedback, richie@theculturalhall.com. You can go to theculturalhall.com and go to the Contact Us tab. You can hit us up on Facebook. It's facebook.com/theculturalhall. Just search The Cultural Hall. We're on Google+. You can find us on Pinterest. That's our biggest social media outlet. Follow us on Twitter @theculturalhall. And if you're just really interested in the articles of news that we do, you can follow @TheMormonNews. That's a daily news service that we do where we send out an email of the latest and greatest of Mormon news. You can subscribe to that and get it to your inbox lovingly at 8 a.m. Mountain Standard Time every weekday, and then there's a late night Sunday edition every weekend. All right, let's get to it. It's episode number 132. We dive headfirst into excommunication and the LDS Church.
Looking for a change in your workout? Are you looking for real results? Pure Bar is the fastest, most effective, yet safest way to transform your body. In just 55 minutes, you will achieve a full body workout on the areas women struggle with the most: hips, seat, abs, and arms. The Pure Bar technique is low impact, protecting your joints by avoiding any bouncing or jumping. The technique works to defy gravity by tapering everything in and lifting it up. Come check out Pure Bar today in Draper at 123rd South and 200 East, just 3 blocks east of the freeway. Your first class is free and there's no obligation. Mention that you heard this ad on Cultural Hall and take 10% off any class package. Give us a call at 801-523-6215 or visit us online at www.purebar.com. That's PUREBARRE.com and select the Draper, Utah location. Pure Bar. Lift. Tone. Burn.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, Let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall, and well, we're talking excommunication, given the subject of light of note of the Bloggernacle of the world of Mormonism online recently, and on the phone with us right now. We're going to do a different take on it. It's Russell Stevenson. Thanks for joining me, my friend.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's the Mormon History Guy, if you listen to that episode. You don't happen to remember the number of your episode, do you?
The number of the episode dealing with ordained women is number 9.
But the one with where we talked to you here in the Cultural Hall, do you remember what that was?
Oh, yeah, for the Cultural Hall, you know, I don't even remember the number for that. My apologies.
It was right around, so you can find it by searching the Cultural Hall and Russell Stevenson, or Mormon History Guy, and you can do mormonhistoryguy.com. Excommunication, not new in the church, but it seems like a lot of hubbub, if I can use that word, being given to both Kate Kelly, the founder of OrdainedWomen.org, and John DeLynn, the founder of Mormon Stories, because it seems to be the first for many of our generation, or at least public excommunication for our generation.
You know, they have been high-profile excommunications, and it's largely because of the public persona they've created. You know, John DeLynn gets over 10,000 downloads a month on average. You know, he's widely popular, and Kate Kelly, she really resonates with some women who feel like they are not being fully used in the church as they would like to be used.
Like you say, people really feel sort of included through these two individuals. And so I think it's not only higher profile, because typically these things of excommunication are kept pretty quiet, you know, typically between the individual and the stake, or the individual and the ward, but also because so many people are beginning now to rally behind both Kate and John.
Yes, in figuring out, really the blow-by-blow or the play-by-play of, how this gets released. I mean, that's information that you almost have to piece together as time goes by. You know, you might see a leaked document here, or a leaked statement there. And for that reason, I've always had an approach of suspended judgment whenever dealing with any disciplinary action, just because, frankly, we do not have access to all sources of information. You know, we can't just go and talk to that counsel and say, okay, exactly, what happened on your end. And, the information that we're often getting in the press is, it's with the lens of New York Times reporters. So our access to information is so limited that my approach has been one of tremendous caution. It's such a sensitive issue, and it's such an important one, not only for them, but for their families.
Well, and quite frankly, it's none of our business, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when it comes down to it, there are a lot of people that are like, man, I want to, but you know what? It really, really isn't any of our business. I myself, being an excommunicated member of the church, and then having gone back through full fellowshipment and now returned to the church, grateful for the opportunity and the things that I learned from it. I don't know that I want to do it again necessarily, but I feel more sure now than I did before, and stronger because of that experience. But I'm certainly not going to share every bit of that experience with everyone, because it's not anyone's business.
Right. I mean, frankly, for those who are believers, in the institutional authority of the church, that process is something of a sacred process. It's not just an organizational decision. Now, for those who reject that, then we're talking about a different matter entirely, and mm-hmm. I respect both perspectives.
But like I said at the very beginning, this isn't the first time, and so why I wanted to get you in is to talk kind of history about excommunication, and maybe a little higher profile excommunications within the LDS Church. So, you ready to do this? You want to go back, or work from the time of Joseph Smith and work forward in time? You pick.
I think it would be best to craft the narrative arc, as we always do, from beginning to the end.
Okay.
Right? So so let's start at the beginning. You know, and you know, there are obviously any number of excommunicated members in any time period. You know, there's a whole collection of them in the Brigham Young papers of the Church History Archives, and some of them are people that you've never heard of, very compelling stories, and there are people that are, you know, well-known. In fact, whole books have been written about them. And I would say probably the highest profile excommunicated Latter-day Saint in the first decade of the Church. You know, there might be a couple others who are vying for the spot, but really it would be Oliver Cowdery, because he was there literally from the beginning. Right? He was there for numerous angelic visitations. He was one of the three witnesses. He played a key role in laying the foundation for the Church. So, you know, if we're going to start looking at the high-profile excommunications, you know, he trumps really any of the excommunications that we've seen in the past, in the past century, certainly. You know, Sonia Johnson, John Dwin, Kate Kelly, others, none of them have had the kind of ecclesiastical prominence that Oliver Cowdery did. So talking about, you know, the undergirding reasons for that excommunication, it can actually reveal quite a bit about, you know, the lines that were drawn in the first generation of the Church.
I feel like it's important to note, at least at this point, at the time of this recording, that the only thing with John Dolan and Kate Kelly is the disciplinary action, that excommunication or disfellowshipment or any sort of church disciplinary action has not, at this point of this recording, taken place.
Right. In fact, if I may actually, in the recording, go back on that, I ended up speaking incorrectly. You can maybe just insert this into the recording.
Okay.
Oliver Cowdery was a higher profile disciplinary action than any other Latter-day Saint in the past century, Sonia Johnson, John Dolan, or Kate Kelly. It's only because none of them had the same kind of ecclesiastical prominence that Oliver Cowdery did.
So we talk about Oliver Cowdery, and obviously we are looking at it in a hindsight. In this generation, no one is alive that knew him. No one, you know, all that we have is written word about him. So what do we know about the excommunication of Oliver Cowdery?
You know, we do have meeting minutes. We have Joseph Smith's journal, and we also have some correspondence that he sent in response to the disciplinary hearings. And it should be noted that, as is often the case in contemporary times, he did not actually show up for his disciplinary hearing.
Oh, really?
He refused to show up. No, he did not. He refused to acknowledge its legitimacy. And there were a few reasons that he was called up for this disciplinary hearing. It wasn't just one thing that he did. For one thing, you know, he was involved in, you know, organizing the land holdings of the church in Missouri, in 1837, 1838. And as he was doing so, he also set up a debt collection business. And, you know, the idea being that, you know, when people had gone into debt for various things, he would go and, you know, arrange for the collection of that debt. And he was doing this in regards to church lands and church property. So in a way, you could argue that he was exploiting the church system towards his own ends. Now, in his eyes, he was exercising his right as an American. This is, you know, free market capitalism. I have the right to do this as a business owner. But that really didn't set so well with the church leadership. They felt like he was going around their backs. But that was only one reason. There was another element, too. Several years earlier, he had caught wind of one of Joseph Smith's earliest, or his Joseph Smith's earliest plural marriage, Fanny Alger. And, you know, Fanny Alger, she was 17 years old, young, attractive, and even to this day, there is tremendous scholarly debate as to whether this was, in fact, a marriage or not. I find the evidence to be compelling that it was a marriage, but there are very intelligent people who do not find the evidence to be so compelling. They just think that it was an affair. Point being, though, that Oliver Cowdery thought it was an illegitimate union, and he felt that it, you know, cast a dark light on Joseph Smith's moral character. And, you know, whenever any of Joseph Smith's brethren would approach Oliver about this, he would become very uncomfortable. And it was Thomas Marsh, you know, who was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve at the time, and he himself would be excommunicated. He approached Oliver Cowdery to ask him about his views on the Fanny Alger incident. And Marsh responded that that Oliver just kind of cocked his head back slightly in a knowing fashion, the kind of thing where he wanted to say it without actually saying it. He didn't want to go on record as saying that Joseph Smith was, in fact, guilty of adultery.
Hmm.
So, you know, this kind of dynamic, it made it clear that Oliver Cowdery no longer saw Joseph Smith as the kind of prophet that he once thought he was.
And so then at that point, that's when the disciplinary action was taken after Oliver Cowdery?
Yes. So it was in 1838. You know, a number of charges were leveled against him. Again, it was Oliver Cowdery was not present for it. He sent a letter protesting, saying, "Listen, I support the church, just not its outward governance. I don't support, you know, the way that you're kind of trying to establish this quasi-theocracy, because I am, at the end of the day, a Republican." Now, by Republican, I mean small r. You know, that's, you know, that was what a lot of, you know, white men like Oliver Cowdery used to describe the relationship to the government in the mid-19th century.
Hmm.
He said, "I am an American and a Mormon. I claim both identities." He dared not ever say that he was a Mormon first and foremost, because he wanted to preserve his rights to run a business as he saw fit.
So in the times of early days with the church, was it a similar setup where it would be, in that case, a Quorum of the Twelve, or not? I guess would it have been the Quorum of the Twelve at that time?
No, they did have a high council in the way that we do now. And this was established a few years earlier. And what's interesting about this, and Richard Bushman points this out in his biography of Joseph Smith, he said that, you know, we like to think of Joseph Smith as being, you know, this charismatic, right, a personality-driven religion. He said, but Bushman argues that Joseph Smith didn't always consider the church to be this kind of structure. He thought organizationally as well as charismatically. So in the mid-1830s, you know, well before Oliver Cowdery's excommunication, he established what he called a standing high council. And this is the kind of level of bureaucracy to which even Joseph Smith himself could be made vulnerable. In fact, after Zion's Camp, you know, Joseph Smith, he wasn't his greatest days on Zion's Camp. You know, he had very public disputes with another camp member named Sylvester Smith. And Joseph Smith himself was called before this council to answer these charges.
Hmm.
And, you know, ultimately he was absolved. But the fact that this was even, you know, a legitimate channel tells you something about, you know, the strength of this bureaucracy that Joseph Smith had established.
So Oliver Cowdery then becomes excommunicated.
He is excommunicated from the church. That's correct.
And as the story goes, we know that he was rebaptized later.
He was. He was. Later on, he joined the church, and Scott Farling has, you know, written an excellent article about, you know, the return of Oliver Cowdery. And both Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris, who was also excommunicated around this time, would return to the church. David Whitmer would not.
Does he express either in that essay or in that article about change of heart that Oliver?
Yes, he does. You know, really, the very first evidence of Oliver experiencing change of heart, it came fairly early on. I mean, as early as 1850. You know, there were some elders who came into contact with him, and they noted that Oliver Cowdery was very friendly. Now, this is only a couple of years after the excommunication. And, you know, if you understand something about the context of Missouri in 1838, we need to understand it was very literally wartime.
Mm-hmm.
And any time you're dealing with a war, whether it's an ideological war or a war of guns and bullets, you know, people are going to be drawing pretty firm lines in the sand. It's the typical psychological response. You know, Jonathan Haidt talks about this in some of his work about how we're already naturally inclined towards tribalism. So, you know, in the context of the war, Oliver Cowdery, you know, he felt one deeply attacked for, you know, for daring to, you know, start up his own business, but two, he had also likely been hearing the kinds of things that, you know, some of the more militant Latter-day Saints were saying, and this just didn't jive with his personality. This is also what would lead to Thomas Marsh's excommunication, at least to some degree. We typically attribute it to, you know, a conflict over milk strippings. You know, his wife claimed that she should have certain milk strippings, and a neighbor said, no, I should. And then supposedly, the story goes, Thomas Marsh just got so caught up in this conflict over milk strippings that he let himself out of the church. I think there's evidence to support that to some degree, but the story is so much more complex. And Oliver Cowdery is part of this environment.
Oliver Cowdery comes back in 1850, which is 6 years after the martyrdom of the prophet Joseph.
That's right.
Oliver Cowdery and Brigham Young, is there a relationship?
You know, Brigham Young was welcoming of Oliver Cowdery. As loyal as Brigham Young was to Joseph Smith, and as rough around the edges as Brigham Young was, you know, he wasn't the kind of person that it was really easy to get along with. But whenever there was an excommunicated member who came back, you know, Martin Harris or Oliver Cowdery, you know, he never told them to go back home. He always told them that they were welcome within the Latter-day Saint community. Now, oftentimes he would include some kind of snarky remark, you know, about old times, and that probably wasn't, you know, the best thing Brigham Young could have said. But he always let them back into the community.
It's interesting to note, though, that barely, you know, you couldn't get more, unless you were a prophet, closer to the Lord, really, than Oliver Cowdery, mm-hmm. right? Being able to see the plates, found him.
Right, and he was there in the Kirtland Temple with Joseph Smith during all those visionary experiences, you know, when Moses came and when Elijah came. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Oliver Cowdery, that's what makes the story so tragic, is we tend to throw him under the bus because of his apostasy in 1838. But before that, there was an 8-year solid record of accomplishment.
But
and, he was there from the beginning.
But I think it's also such a dramatic example of that change of heart and of hope,
yes.
and of love and of the opportunity that he took for himself to then realign himself with the saints and find himself as a member of the church again in 1850. Who's next?
You know, there are any number of people that we could discuss, but one that I find to be particularly compelling is a man by the name of William Godby. Now, William Godby, like Oliver Cowdery, he had a very strong record, you know, in terms of his relationship, not only to the early Latter-day Saints, but also to the Utah Church. He was a great businessman. He was tremendously talented as far as his ability to organize people. But he also had a certain affection for, you know, the world of the Eastern United States. See, but by the time he was excommunicated in the late 1860s, there had been a long-standing divide between the Mormon community and Easterners. You know, the Mormon community, they had identified themselves as, you know, Zion in the midst of the wilderness, and they were trying to leave the Americans. America was supposed to have self-destructed during the Civil War. At least that's what many people were expecting. And at the very least, they saw Easterners as hypocritical and materialistic, capitalistic, whereas Mormons were self-reliant. You know, they tried to make things on their own, and they were not dependent upon, you know, the Industrial Revolution for their goods. William Godby had a different kind of paradigm. He said, you know, we should actually be a lot more welcoming to Eastern goods. We should be more welcoming to Eastern industry. And frankly, Eastern ideas. you know, we're going off of all these, like, these old notions. You know, one prominent follower of William Godwin, John Lindsay, he very publicly attacked the idea of the curse of Cain as being, you know, the reason that black people had black skin.
Mm-hmm.
His argument, of course, you know, he wasn't, I wouldn't call him any kind of a modern-day progressive or liberal in the sense that he was a racial egalitarian. He just said, we can't talk about it as the curse of Cain. Rather, it is a, you know, the development of natural courses, right? You know, there are better peoples, there are inferior peoples. It was essentially kind of a social Darwinism, which was fairly chic at that time. So, you know, William Godby, as well as his followers, they believed in America, and they believed in capitalism, and they believed in the God of nature. One thing that they always said is, you know, if you just looked around you, you know, you would see God in nature, and that's the best way to understand God, not through these old traditions that we've inherited. And no, they didn't claim to be anti-Mormons. In fact, they claimed to be very faithful Mormons. They just said, we want to, you know, bring light into our Mormon community. We do not want to dismantle it. But Brigham Young, he did not share those views. From his perspective, you know, the Latter-day Saints needed to, at the very most, control and regulate the influx of Eastern goods, Eastern ideas, and Eastern infrastructure. You know, they saw it as something of a threat. Now, you know, maybe if they could, you know, redirect the inflow of Eastern goods and Eastern ideas and, you know, reappropriate them towards their own ends, then maybe that would work. And that's what you see them do in regards to the Transcontinental Railroad. They have a number of Mormon men, you know, serve as laborers for the railroad companies in order to prevent Gentiles from coming into the territory.
So what's the grounds for excommunication here?
The grounds for excommunication, basically, is that he was publicly attacking Brigham Young's economic protectionism, his desire to isolate to some degree the Latter-day Saints from this influx of Eastern goods and ideas.
So what happened?
What ended up happening is he developed a following, and it was a faction. Again, they considered themselves Mormons, but he was excommunicated. A number of his top-level followers were excommunicated, and within a few years, they were basically forgotten. But at the time, they were illustrative of, you know, the kinds of discourses that were happening in Utah about Utah's economic and ideological relationship with the rest of the United States.
That's cool. I'd never heard of that story before about Godby.
Yeah, there's a great book on him by Ron Walker, who also co-authored the book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It's a book called Wayward Saints, and it's a group biography of William Godby and his followers. So,
coming,
it's a fascinating story.
Coming back in the third block here of the Culture Hall, we're going to keep going. Who are we going to talk about next?
You know, we're going to jump ahead considerably. Yeah, if only because, you know, we want to start talking about people who we might know or might be more familiar with. So another compelling example is Sonia Johnson.
Okay, so that's coming. We'll do that coming back in the third block. Or do you want to tease a little more? I'll let you tease a little bit more, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, sure. And, you know, Sonia Johnson's the name of her memoir is called From Housewife to Heretic, and study of that transformation is a fascinating one. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you.
All right, coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Hey, this is Dan, the Laptop Man from PC Laptops. I'm so excited. It only happens once a year. It's time for the annual PC Laptops Super Spring Blowout Sale with up to 50% off the original prices on desktop and laptop computers. We have demos, scratch and dents, and trade-ins. Right now, buy any new PC Laptops computer and get a free multi-pass. That's a full 3-day pass to Salt Lake Comic-Con Fan Experience, April 17th through 19th at the Salt Palace, while supplies last. And to make it extra easy, we're doing no interest if paid in full within 12 months. OAC. So please visit us at any one of our 8 locations right now or call us at 1-877-5 596-SAVE or check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. At PC Laptops, we really love you. That's PCLaptops.com.
We invite you to claim your courage by shedding shameful thoughts, actions, and feelings that disrupt your ability to live authentically or feel connected to others by letting go of fear, blame, and your idea of perfection. The Healing Group, where women go for hope, growth, and healing. We're the home of the Sex Girls. Are you a mother feeling lost in a relationship and feeling stuck? Are you feeling overwhelmed by life? Schedule an appointment now. Can't make it to our office? No problem. Meet with a therapist individually or with a group in our virtual clinic right from the comfort of your own home. Visit thehealinggroup.com for more information.
Time for the third block of the Cultural Hall, joined by the Mormon history guy. It's Russell Stevenson. We're talking about excommunication because of all this stuff in the news, and doing kind of a historical look at Mormon folk of note that have dealt with excommunication and have either come back to the church or have not. And where we left off was with Sonia Johnson, and the title of her memoir you mentioned right before the break was From Housewife to Heretic. So let's dive in.
Yes. So Sonia Johnson, I've looked through several of her letters and her other of her papers at the University of Utah Special Collections. It's an enormous collection, and it's a rich treasure trove of documentation regarding Mormon life in the 1960s and 1970s. So studying her, it's useful not only for understanding excommunication, but also for understanding about what it was like to be a housewife in the 1960s and 1970s. And I will say, as far as the title of her book goes, just on its face, if you stop at the title, it strikes me as pretty true to form. So in the mid-1960s and in the early 1970s, Sonia Johnson was a committed Latter-day Saint, and I can say that full stop. She constantly referenced her activity in the church, prayers, reading scriptures. In fact, when Joseph Fielding Smith became the president of the church in 1971, she made a comment to her mother saying, I'm not terribly comfortable with Joseph Fielding Smith. He's a bit dogmatic. But, she said, the Lord is also dogmatic. Maybe I am not dogmatic enough.
So
she was committed.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to point out, too, that in that time frame, just kind of historically, 60s into the early 70s, kind of a sexual revolution, and then also almost a, and I hate to use the term, but a feministic movement as well.
Oh, certainly. Ever since, the writing of Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, you do see an awakening of women's liberation movements. You have the famous protest at the Atlantic City Miss America pageant, where they protest all the trappings of traditional femininity, saying it was oppressive and all that kind of thing. It would be incorrect, however, to closely associate Sonia Johnson with any of that.
But
frankly, she wasn't even America. It wasn't even in America during most of the late 1960s and early 1970s. She was living in West Africa with her husband, who was doing a fellowship with USAID.
So then what's her story then? If not here and inspired by those ideas here in America, where, what happened?
Well, while she was in West Africa, her first awakening, it had nothing to do with feminism. It actually had to do with race. She had always been fairly racially progressive, especially for her family. Her father was, she said, not particularly keen on the black community. So she felt comfortable going to Africa. But while she was there, she came to this realization. She said, even now as I'm writing this letter, I'm sensing that this will be the defining issue for the Latter-day Saints over the next several years. She said, I'm not even saying, it's President McKay's job to have a revelation on this, but somebody's going to need to. And this is when she acknowledges that this could be something that, that makes the Mormons who they are in the public eye during that time period. So she's going through this kind of thought process, again, long before she has any kind of feminist awakening. And in the mid-1970s, you know, she cites quite approvingly a comment by President Kimball that actually lambasts, you know, some of the sexual, you know, activities on campuses. You know, she was conservative, morally speaking. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. She was conservative, sexually speaking, in the mid-1970s. It wasn't until a couple of years later when she's beginning to be exposed to some of the feminist literature. And again, even as she's supporting the fairly newly formed Equal Rights Amendment, which was very simply put that there would be no gender distinction, you know, in American law of any kind. But even as she's supporting that, she always considered herself to be a committed Latter-day Saint.
So where does she run afoul with the church?
Well, around the same time that she's supporting the Equal Rights Amendment, in fall of 1976, the church leadership releases a statement specifically opposing the Equal Rights Amendment.
Hmm.
And this frustrated her, but at the end of the day, she did not let it stop her. She, you know, continued to, you know, protests at college campuses and that kind of thing, and you know, people would come up to her and say, "Hey, we thought that you would be excommunicated by now." And her response always was, "Well, you know, we do not think the church is a totalitarian organization, so we're safe." And she, you know, she confided to her mother that she didn't ever feel terribly confident, you know, in saying that. She always had her suspicions, but at the end of the day, she publicly said the church, you know, is not the kind of organization that would crack down on us. But then as time goes on and as she continues to insist on supporting the Equal Rights Amendment, I would say even, you know, going to the point of accusing church leadership and church members of what she called savage misogyny, that's in quotes, and, you know, that's something that we know that she accused the church of.
Mm-hmm.
As she began to level those attacks, church leaders felt compelled to respond.
What was the church's opposition to the Human Rights Amendment?
Not the Human or Equal Rights
Amendment. Equal Rights Amendment, I'm sorry.
Right, so their argument was, they said, listen, in and of itself, in and of its, in the language, you know, there didn't appear to be too much that was that would have been threatening to church doctrine. Right? Because it just says that there will be no distinction based on sex or gender. So you look at it and say, well, that's, you know, that's innocent enough. But according to the church, they said, no, you aren't seeing where this could possibly lead, right? This could lead towards, you know, women being drafted into the military. This could lead towards unisex bathrooms.
Mm.
This could lead to the breaking down of any kind of gender distinction, you know, in public life. And once you send that message, once you start saying that there is no gender distinction, then they felt it would have an irreversible effect on, you know, how we as men and women see ourselves. I know you can agree or disagree with that. There are a lot of people who said, listen, that's being paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're reading things into the amendment that aren't actually there. But you know, the church firmly believed that the Equal Rights Amendment did pose a threat to how we construct gender in the society.
So until the time where she begins to attack church leaders, it seems to me that it is sort of a tolerable thing. But like, to me, that seems where the offense would come, where the church would have to react, because at some point you can be called names and you can be personally attacked. But I think at some point you have to stand up for yourself. Otherwise, people go, oh, well, maybe they really think that they are that.
According to her, to the correspondence that is in the special collections at the U, you know, her leadership did specifically say, specifically her bishop, said that, you know, I know women who are faithful members of the church who support the ERA, but they are not doing and saying the things that you are doing and saying. And that's what distinguishes you from the rest. Now, it's worth noting that Sonia Johnson did not take the disciplinary hearing sitting down. She actually appealed the disciplinary hearing, the excommunication ultimately, all the way to the top, appealed to the state president, and even wrote President Kimball begging for her to be able to keep her membership.
Which ultimately was
with no success. But, you know, I read the letter that she wrote to President Kimball, and assuming that the copy I read is a true copy, and I have no reason to believe that it isn't, you know, even in the letter, she acknowledged that he was the president of the church and a servant of Jesus Christ, and she trusted that he would make the right decision and so on and so forth. But by that point, she had said, a few things about church culture and church leadership, including that the church was guilty of savage misogyny.
It is interesting to note, and not often pointed out, too, that people can appeal rulings of excommunication.
They can. There's a channel for that. I don't have any information as to how often that is successful. I only know a certain number of people who've been excommunicated in my life, and to my knowledge, they have not gone through that process. But yes, that option is available.
Well, and for me, having been excommunicated, my thought was this. I believe that these leaders, mine was on a stake level, I believe that these leaders are inspired by God, and that the call down that they would give would be what God truly, intended for me in my life, right? I had that faith that the excommunication or not excommunication would be the thing that God intended for me to experience. Mm. And so when they brought up the idea of appeal, to me, it almost seemed like the idea of appeal is more of a proclamation that I don't have faith that these people were inspired in their decision.
Interesting, right? And obviously, in your particular circumstances, you would know best, what the decision did or did not mean. I do think of a quote that Elder Packer said in a BYU devotional, where he said that in church leadership and church administration, human nature may manifest itself on occasion, but never to the permanent detriment of the work. And it's for that reason that, whenever someone says, hey, what do you think about so-and-so's excommunication? And you really insert any name, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. My response would always be, I do not have the kind of information that I would need to have to make a judgment as to, whether that was a right or wrong decision. I have not talked to the High Councilman, and oftentimes I haven't even talked to the person who is facing disciplinary hearing because I don't have that kind of relationship with them, or I don't even feel comfortable bringing up that kind of conversation with them. It's just none of my business, as we said earlier. So that's been my general policy in discussing any disciplinary matters whatsoever. So I'm really grateful that you have that kind of confirmation in your particular circumstances.
Let's move along. So who's next?
Well, I would say that the next interesting group is the September 6th. Now, when we think about the September 6th, and just for the record, that's a term that was coined by the press at the time and is stuck, and understandably so. It was a group of six academics, associated with Brigham Young University. And, many of them, consider themselves to be feminists. For in the case of D. Michael Quinn, he actually styles himself to be a conservative, and he's a conservative in the sense we should maybe look back to the kind of original foundation that Joseph Smith laid, and he claims I felt the Spirit while reading the Book of Mormon. I have a testimony in the Book of Mormon, but in most cases, they had gone public with their disputes with church leadership, particularly. Elder Boyd K. Packer. Now, again, I don't have access to anything beyond what is publicly known. But suffice it to say that people like D. Michael Quinn and Elder Boyd K. Packer had very different ideas as to how to handle these kinds of academic debates.
Like what?
Well, for example, D. Michael Quinn, he was a pretty prolific writer on matters of church history, and frankly, he is a fantastic historian in a lot of ways. From the perspective of D. Michael Quinn, historians needed to basically open up the archives, let it all out, let everyone see it. Whereas, you know, over Boyd K. Packer, you know, he made the famous comment, you know, some things that are true are not very useful. And he was worried about the kind of impact that this information could have on someone who's just becoming acquainted with the Latter-day Saint faith. And he said it's one thing to, you know, have these kinds of conversations, you know, amongst mature Latter-day Saints who've been involved in the church for an extended period of time. It's quite another to, you know, flash them in front of a brand-new convert, say, did you know this about Brigham Young? He said that's not really fair to them. And this kind of dispute, it eventually bubbled up into public discourse to the point where, you know, D. Michael Quinn and others were publicly criticizing church leaders for, you know, suppressing academic freedom and that kind of thing.
As a historian, that idea of opening the floodgates and allowing all the information to be out, I think we see a great portion of that with just the internet and everything like that. But what is your feeling on that idea of having all the information out there?
Well, you know, from my perspective, you know, anytime you write a book, just by the nature of the project, you must be selective. It's just, it's necessary. Like, there is no way that you can present every piece of information that could be possibly relevant to the topic. Some people have tried, and they've come, you know, they've done a reasonably good job of it. But any time a quotation mark is used, it means that your reader is now getting a summary of the documents that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And the reader is basically trusting you to give a fair summary of that, to the point where, you know, if they were to see the documents side by side with your summary, they would say, okay, I feel like, you know, Russell Stevenson has told me the truth. So from the perspective of, you know, I think we must acknowledge that, you know, you just can't tell everything. Now, that being said, you know, when Elder Practice says some things that are true are not very useful, I can agree with that in theory. I can agree with that in the sense that, you know, there are certain aspects to a person's life, like, you know, one's shoe size or, you know, the size of one's pants, that may or may not be useful to me as a reader. Mm-hmm. Like, frankly, I don't care.
Yeah. But I wanted to know what size Brigham Young's shoe was.
Oh, I know. It's so important. But, you know, let's, you know, just to be candid, that's really not what Elder Packer was talking about. You know, he was talking about character flaws. He was talking about, you know, personal issues that Joseph Smith or Brigham Young or other church leaders may have suffered from that could cast them in a negative light. So, you know, when I think of Elder Packer's comments about, you know, how there are some things that are true that are not very useful, I think about it in the sense that, you know, a person, you know, shouldn't be, you know, writing up some kind of muckraking scandal sheet. Right? I'm going to go out there and scandalize everybody. I'm going to shock them and, you know, fundamentally dismantle their testimony of the presence of the church. Yeah. I can sympathize with that because, frankly, I just don't write that kind of history about anybody. I just wrote an article about Adam Yarmolinsky. I guarantee you haven't heard of him.
Nope.
He's fairly obscure. He was a policymaker during the 1960s. He played a role in Vietnam War policymaking and especially in the war on poverty. And he was basically a bureaucrat. And my perspective in writing any kind of biography is to try to step into their world. Right, to see the world as they see it, and that's what makes history such an empathetic enterprise from my perspective. So when I look at the D. Michael Quinn Elder Packer conflict, to be honest, I hate to play the ambivalence card, but I can actually sympathize with both sides. Mm-hmm. And Phil Barlow, you know, said something to that effect not long ago on the anniversary of the September 6th excommunication.
So with the September 6th, I'm curious. I mean, everybody knows Oliver Cowdery came back.
Right.
September 6th, as I understand it, a couple of the September 6th have come back. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Avraham Gileadi has come back, and as well as Maxine Hanks. The other four, you know, they continue to be involved in Mormon discourse. And you know, they, in fact, at the Sunstone Symposium, they even had a kind of remembering the September 6th panel discussion, where you know they talked about their experiences since then and reflected on the kinds of conversations they had at the time.
Maxine Hanks has come back within just the last couple of years. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's been fairly recent.
What in her story are you aware of, or maybe you're not aware? What does she say of her experience in coming back?
To be honest, I know very little, if anything, of her. I know about as much as you do.
Yeah, only that she has, in fact, come back.
I know that she has, in fact, come back.
Very little of Abraham, is that how you say it?
Abraham.
Abraham. Only that he's come back as well.
Only that he's come back as well. I also know that he has sought to maintain a fairly low profile. I've had like friends of friends who've had conversations with him about various things, but I don't really feel at liberty to discuss rumors about them.
Sure,
they've said publicly. Yeah.
But interesting to note that he has just decided, you know what, I'm back in and not so vocal, maybe.
Right. And, you know, I've read his work. You know, he was actually an Old Testament scholar. And, you know, he's written some very good things on Isaiah. I think they're very enlightening and illuminating. And you know, I felt the spirit for those who are inclined to use that kind of language while reading them. So I certainly enjoyed what he wrote, you know, before his excommunication.
Are there others now which you wish to talk about before we talk a little bit about John and Kate?
No, I think that covers really the spectrum of the kinds of excommunication experiences that people have had. You know, with Oliver Cowdery's case, you're dealing with a fundamental divide over how the church should be governed. You know, with William Godbey, it's about the relationship between Utah/the church and the rest of American society. You know, Sonia Johnson, it's over issues regarding feminism and women's rights. That gives us a pretty good smorgasbord of what it's been like to be an excommunicated Latter-day Saint over the course of the past 180 years or so.
And now enter into the discussion, and again, worth pointing out that both John DeLynn and Kate Kelly not excommunicated, but merely the speculation is that they very well could be.
Right. And then that's the point that it can't be repeated often enough. We can't just talk about excommunication as being the inevitable result here. There are actually any number of things that could happen. It could be an excommunication. It could be a disfellowshipping. It could be an even milder disciplinary action. We really don't know. And, it depends on a lot of things.
How much have you been following the whole thing since it was announced?
I recently wrote a post for Rational Faith regarding not so much the DeLynn-Kelly hearings per se, but rather the response of faithful Latter-day Saints to them. And I think that is at least as important of a discussion. And unfortunately, I'm seeing a sense of triumphalism.
Like they had it coming, or we finally got them, that kind of thing?
Yeah, hallelujah. The church is true. Finally they're dropping dropping the gauntlet. Finally they're drawing a line. And, these are the kinds of comments made out of frustration. Right. It's made out of pain. They see, in their eyes, they see somebody who is consistently attacking a faith community they live, and the fact that they even see it as attacking at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask John or Kate, they'd say, no, we're not attacking. We're asking for change. But yes, I see this triumphalism, and even if someone is a card-carrying member of the church, they raise their hand to the square at every conference, and they do so proudly. From my perspective, triumphalism is an absolutely inappropriate response to this kind of thing. And I think about my own father. And, my father, he is as orthodox as they come. And he was once involved in a disciplinary hearing. He sat in for somebody. And he heard all of the gory details of of a person's activities and decisions. And I heard some things in his experience. I mean, it was kind of a whole high-profile thing. There was no way you could get away from what happened. So there was no keeping it a secret. But what he told me about it, it was not triumphalism. There was no happiness that day. None of us were saying, oh, good, finally, so-and-so's been excommunicated. They really deserved it. It was a look of pain, of sadness. And it was the kind of thing, and for lack of a better comparison, you know, I think about, you know, when you get some young whippersnapper going and talking to an old war veteran and talking about, yeah, did you kill the Nazis? Did you kill the Japs? You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And all that's in quotes. And, you know, the old war veteran just looks at them and basically says, war is hell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the kind of the mojo that I got, is like, you should not be happy about this. This is not a happy occasion. And that's what I've been following, and it's broken my heart to see that, because even if somebody thinks that John DeLaney and Kate Kelly are the threats that they think them to be, there are people who feel very strongly about them, who feel a resonance with them. I count some of my closest friends as being among them. They feel like John DeLaney has spoken to them. So when you say those kinds of things about John DeLynn, you are in effect saying that about people that you don't really mean to be saying it about.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there will be a sense of, because there are a lot of people that are defending both Kate and John at this point, a really difficult decision for individuals should they find themselves excommunicated? Like those people who really have found a home with Mormon Stories, or who have really, you know, found their faith again through ordained women, to find those individuals excommunicated. Do you think it'll be a large question of faith?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, as a believing Latter-day Saint, I really hope that they can, you know, piece together something like faith, you know, in the wake of this. You know, if they are one of these people who really connected with the message of ordained women, or connected with the message of Mormon Stories, gosh, I hope they can. I hope they find a way. But it's hard for me to say. I mean, John DeLynn gets 11,000 downloads a month, and that's a lot of people. And, you know, that's a lot of stories and a lot of experiences. And he attracts a wide coalition of people. So I can't really say, but I really hope that they do find a way to stay in the Mormon community.
Let me ask you, if they find themselves excommunicated, does that pose any sort of thought in struggle of faith for you personally?
You know, I know John personally. I'm a friend of his family's, actually. I got to know family members of his before I got to know him. And I think John is a likable person. In fact, I sat 5 feet from him in a temple ceiling when I was there for his nephew's ceiling several years back. And my faith is grounded in other things. My faith is grounded in, you know, the feelings I've had as I've read the revelations of Joseph Smith. And but let me make it clear, by feelings, you know, we're not talking about like warm, fuzzy, you know, oh, this is the after effects of barbecue kind of feelings. So, I mean, feelings of clarity, of insight, of, you know, of powerful connectiveness to other people, to, you know, my pursuit for knowledge and you know, and Zion and those kinds of things. When I read those things, I feel like there is something grander at work. It paints a vision of something that I want to be a part of. And, you know, sometimes I may need to do that on my own terms, in my own way, maybe in ways that not a lot of people understand. But that's where my faith is grounded. And, you know, my feelings about John and Kate as individuals, you know, I hope the best for their family. I hope the best for them. I hope that they can find spiritual healing and wholeness in the wake of all this, whatever happens.
It's a fascinating thing, and certainly now a lot of people just kind of waiting to hear one way or another. And I think a very valid point that you have about the triumphalism, you know, even to me, my take is this: agree with them or don't agree with them, I think that they have caused a lot of people to think. And whether or not you agree, it caused you to stop and go, how do I feel about women in the priesthood? I agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think that maybe they should have expanded roles, but not the priesthood, whatever the thing is. But if there was an opportunity where you thought more about your faith, had the opportunity to go to our Heavenly Father and say, you know what, I'm trying to figure this stuff out, and was able to have a spiritual experience, an affirmation on some level about where your testimony lies, or you know, where you're grounded in, I feel like those are positive things.
Yes, and you know, speaking to my own experience, as is somewhat known at this point, you know, I publicly debated John DeLand on NPR about 6 months ago, and you know, we discussed, you know, the new race and the priesthood statement, and we vigorously disagreed. I continue to disagree with John DeLand on many fundamental points. It wouldn't be a stretch for me to say that perhaps some of our differences are ideologically irreconcilable. So I'm not coming from somebody, this is not coming from somebody who feels that I'm really on board with a lot of John's message. But, you know, as I think about the kind of work that John has done, the kind of work that Kate has done, and I think about friends of mine who have felt something in regards to their message, I'm not in my place. I don't get paid enough to say, okay, well, you know, your experiences are illegitimate. You know, I have expressed concerns about the tactics of both. You know, sometimes I've seen divisiveness, I've seen factionalizing. I worry about that. But that notwithstanding, I don't think that we can just toss aside the lived experiences of those who have found meaning in the words that they've said. Now, you could easily argue that, you know, these are the kinds of people who would find meaning in a lot of things, right? They would find spirituality in a lot of things, and they just so happen to find it through John DeLand. I don't know. But whatever we do, we must try to save as many souls, keep as many people as we can. Like Robert Mellis said on my podcast a little while ago, I believe in a big church.
Yeah. I appreciate you taking a few minutes and, you know, sharing everything that you know, everything that you studied up for, to be able to share this with us. And I'm excited to see what happens. I think, like you say, though, I think at the end of the road, and as we have said at the very beginning, you know, it really is their deal. And, you know, my hope is that they get from it what they need. I know from my experience personally, the opportunity they had to be excommunicated and then find my way back through the disciplinary actions and those things, and find myself now in full fellowship with the church, with the ability, you and I went to the temple together.
Right.
And to be able to
have this experience.
Yeah, to be able to have that experience and to have the perspective of living without it and living with it, to me, you know, it makes it that much more precious. And I continue to learn about why it was a necessary thing for me to be excommunicated. So I hope whatever the decision is, that it is for the very best of the welfare of both John and Kate.
And, you know, let me just tell you, Rich, I really respect and appreciate, you know, your transparency in sharing that story. There are some who don't feel comfortable sharing it, and that's their prerogative. And, you know, I don't know what kind of place they are in their life, but I know that your willingness to share has helped people come to grips with their own faith journey. And that must be, that must not be terribly easy to be so open about something so sensitive. So let me say, I appreciate any kind of sacrifice that you make in the telling of that story.
Let me ask you, Russell, where can people find and hear and learn more about you and what you're doing? Give a little plug. Climb up on the Ramayumptum and let people know.
All right. I'll give you my little Ramayumptum speech. Well, of course, we have my website, www.mormonhistoryguy.com. We have several podcasts available for your listening pleasure.
And that's all thanks to the good work of Nick Galletti, who is my my sound man, and he's brilliant too. So I put in a plug for him. I have a forthcoming book, and it is called For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism. And it covers the entirety of the Black Mormon experience from 1830 until 2013. And by entirety, I mean a representative sample. Right. So, you know, we talk about the West African saints, about South Africa, about Brazil, and obviously about the African-American experience. And also, unlike a lot of books, the second half of the book will be made up entirely of annotated transcriptions of primary documents. Hmm. So, you know, we're going to have, you know, speeches, letters, journal entries that deal with the Black Mormon experience. That allows readers to get a sense for the kinds of things I see, and then they can maybe make some judgments on their own.
And you'll come back and talk about that when that book gets closer to release?
Gladly. You've got first crack at it, Richie.
Promise.
Yes.
All right.
I made that promise to you a long time ago, and I'm a man of my word.
All right. I appreciate you taking a few minutes. I hope that this show has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week. Bless the refreshments.
I'm back already, Rich. I'm feeling it right now. So thank you.
In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat. Oh.